Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Retreat. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Since this is Halloween, I'm in costume while I host the show. This year, I've chosen to be Cupid with a big red heart on my chest. Doing the show this way is quite an achievement because at my age, it's not easy to have a big heart on for an entire hour. If I'm going to do a bad joke, I should at least say it right. Oh, well. Our guest tonight.
All I can say is, Bob, I'm happy I'm not in the studio to see that.
Good. That way I can lie and get away with it when there's nobody here. Our guest tonight is poker player and filmmaker Scott Bell, who has produced a documentary called Ultimate Beat about the rise and fall of the Ultimate Bet online poker site. We'll be talking to Scott momentarily. Delaware had a soft launch of its online poker site. Assuming all goes well in the trial run, on November 8th, which is Friday next week, Delaware residents will be able to play poker online. That brings the U.S. total to three states. Are you planning to move to Delaware, Richard?
Well, I don't know, but I have to say I'm really thrilled about Delaware because it's not just poker. This is the first state that is it has legalized table games and slot machines. So, you know, it'll be full online gambling, which I'm very enthusiastic about, and I hope it goes well and will spread rapidly across the United States. You know, poker is great, but to have full online gambling is much better.
I agree.
Yeah.
It hasn't been a good week to be Caesars Entertainment, the largest casino company in the world. According to an article by Howard Stutz in the Las Vegas Review-Journal, within the past week, they lost out on a $1 billion casino bid in Boston because the Massachusetts Gaming Commission decided they weren't fit to operate casinos in that state. That's a pretty severe charge for a company that operates 54 casinos in 13 states. Regulators in other states may well take notice of this event, and Caesars may face problems down the road. In addition to that, they found out that they had a partner in this boutique casino hotel that used to be called Barbary Coast and then Bill's and was going to be called Gang's Fort or something like that. One of the investors has mob ties. And so that fell through. And then they had to announce a report where they're being investigated by the Internal Revenue Service for violations of the Bank Secrecy Act. And then there was a killing in the Bally's parking garage. And then there was a dead baby in the dumpster behind Planet Hollywood. Then they reported losses in the third quarter of something like $750 million. Not surprisingly, CZR stock has dropped this past week. What do you make of this, Munch?
Oh, you know, I'm ambivalent. I mean, it's sad to see all this happening. At the same time, it's been really sad to watch Harrah's drive properties into the ground. And I hope that this will, you know, cause them enough financial problems that they'll have to sell off some of the properties. It would be good to get better owner managers, you know, in charge of a lot of these properties because, boy, they've just really gone downhill since they've taken over a lot of places.
Yeah, in addition to better owner managers, just different owner managers where there's competition between properties. That would be better for the players. Still related to Caesars Entertainment, they own the World Series of Poker brand, and the main event, Final Table, will take place Monday and Tuesday of next week. ESPN will televise the final table semi-live, meaning it will be live, but there's a 15-minute delay. During last year's telecast, the players all seemed to take 2 minutes to make every decision, including really obvious faults. That made the show essentially unwatchable for the vast majority of the potential audience. If that happens again this year, it's a good bet that ESPN will think twice before televising the final table live again in the future. Are you planning to watch this, Richard?
You know, I will probably turn it on, and my suspicion is it'll be unwatchable again. I'm sure that the producers of the show are pushing the players as hard as they can to speed up their play, trying to do everything to make it a more exciting event. But, you know, I don't think there's much hope. And I think that a lot of the players are aware that they're getting camera time. When they stop and go into the tank, the camera is focused on them. And they know that. And a lot of them want camera time. You know, they're trying to get sponsorship deals if they don't have them already. And anyway, so I think just the whole idea of doing it live is a bad one to start with, because I just don't think you can make it exciting. But we shall see. But my suspicion is that it'll be really boring, and that next year it'll be taped first and edited, and before we see it.
But if you had any tells that you give off, wouldn't be doing nothing for 2 minutes with the camera on you show those tells to the whole world?
I guess.
Is this not a concern to these guys? It might not.
Probably not, because, well, I mean, maybe it could reveal something in a cash game. I mean, I'm sure people will tape these things and study the players, and yeah, maybe someone would be able to take advantage of it in a cash game. But I think that's probably the last thing on their mind when they're playing on the final table of the World Series.
Okay, well, we haven't introduced our guest yet, but Scott Bell is also a poker player. Scott, do you have any thoughts about the live broadcast this coming week?
Well, I haven't really followed live poker that much this year, as I've been kind of really tied up with this film, but I know it is a hot topic on the forums amongst players. I know that, you know, putting clocks into effect and that kind of thing are really topics that have been under a lot of discussion. I kind of go back actually to sort of a little pet idea that I've had for some time, and it actually even relates to the subject of the film, and that poker players probably at some point really do need to have some kind of a players organization, somebody to set sort of a standard set of rules, basic set of rules. And that probably would include some kind of a time period, you know, a set time period before clock can be called and all of that kind of stuff. I think right now where you have all these different venues can set their own rules, and, you know, we have tournament directors calling and interpreting rules differently, you're probably going to run into this situation where players just tank forever, and when they do, like you say, it becomes unwatchable.
You know, that's an interesting idea, and I remember in the very early years there were a number of players who did not like the release that they wanted them to sign. And I mean, are you forced? I guess you're forced to go on television even if you don't want to. I guess you have to just forfeit your spot if you refuse to sign the release. I don't know what happens in that situation.
Yeah, I imagine not too many people would take that very far, just simply because of the amount of money involved, and obviously, you know, being on television is going to result in a lot of additional opportunities for these guys. But there's just a limit to it, you know. So I think when some of the first pros really started these long 2, 3, 4, and 5 minute tank sessions, you know, to sort of think through a hand, there probably was validity to it. I mean, the way the game has evolved, you know, second, third, and fourth level thinking has become, you know, pretty ingrained. And so there probably was some of that, and it was probably legitimate in some cases. But now I think a lot of it is just showmanship. It's just posturing. And And somehow they need to come up with some way to essentially just nip that. Maybe it's like football, you know, where you get so many challenges. Maybe you get so many tanks, and then that's it, you know.
Well, before we hear from Scott Bell anymore, let's introduce him. He has a background in both videography and poker. He composed more than 100,000 words about Ultimate Bet Fiasco on the website deadmoneybook.wordpress.com. His newest work, Ultimate Beat, talks about the meltdown of the Ultimate Bet poker site, and he's here tonight to talk about this documentary film. Scott Bell, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Glad to be here.
Oh, wow. We do have a new producer tonight. I wonder if anybody noticed. But good. That was interesting.
So the crowd doesn't normally go wild.
Well,
that was a first for us.
the crowd in here is as legitimate as my Halloween costume. All right. So, first of all, Scott, why don't you give our listeners a 10-minute summary of what the entire Ultimate Bet Fiasco was all about, and then once we're up to speed on the underlying story, we'll address some specific aspects of the film.
Yeah, sure. It's a good way to approach it too, because the actual crime itself was kind of not even as important as the aftermath and the crimes committed, sort of covering up the crime. So, you know, Ultimate Bet was one of the very early online poker rooms. It actually was, the idea for Ultimate Bet germinated back in the late 1990s. It was started essentially by Phil Hellmuth, and he came up with the idea and with a friend kind of sat around and decided they thought starting an online poker room might be an interesting idea. They really didn't have any management or computer development or programming skills, so that didn't really go very far. But Phil lives up in Silicon Valley or up near that area, and so he got introduced to some guys in Oregon, and that was sort of a marriage made in heaven or hell, whatever you want to look at it as, and they ended up beginning the corporate company underneath that would ultimately become Ultimate Bet's software development shop and so forth. What happens then is they get off the ground, they start this company up with a mix of techies from up around the Oregon area and then old school poker hustlers from down in Las Vegas. And the poker guys are responsible for most of the investment. And so they get a say, you know, they get some kind of a determination in how the site's going to run and, you know, actually running the site. And even though the site is actually sort of based fictitiously in Antigua, it's really kind of run out of Vegas and Portland, Oregon. And it goes, you know,
I'm
fairly
sorry, can I just stop you for a minute?
Sure.
Who were the poker guys that were involved there that you mentioned?
Yeah, okay. So the initial investment was Ted Forrest. Ted Forrest was actually Phil Hellmuth's backer back in at that time frame for tournaments and so forth. As I understand it, I think Phil was pretty deep in the makeup actually at the time to Ted. Phil was having a pretty bleak 2-year run. Phil Hellmuth, I'm not sure how poker savvy your listeners are, but Phil Hellmuth was the youngest World Series of Poker winner in 1989. I think he was like 24 years old when he won it. And so he, you know, he's obviously a well-known quantity. I think he has the most World Series bracelets right now. And he brought in basically people he knew. And so Ted was somebody who delivered a couple $100,000 in cash, for, you know, typical Vegas investment, delivered out of the trunk of his car, you know, and bills. And so the techies all sort of didn't really, you know, they'd never been exposed to that before. You know, they didn't know that's how things worked. And so they got it off the ground. Russ Hamilton was an early person who was brought on, a good friend of Phil's, 1994 World Series of Poker champion. Russ brought along a guy named Mansoor Matlouby, another World Series of Poker main event champion. Dewey Weam, a few other poker players. Those are the core ones that were brought on at first. And of those, really only Russ had this desire to sort of, you know, be a manager, be somebody who sort of had operational, you know, abilities and responsibilities. Phil just wanted to have sort of a passive investment and, you know, be a celebrity poker player. And the other guys essentially were taking Russ's cues, and that's how the company got off the ground. It didn't really get, it got started dealing live poker in 2001, but, you know, back then, it really was a very slow kind of growth. You had Rounders came out in 1998, kind of ignited this little wave of poker. And then, of course, we all sort of recognized 2004 and Chris Moneymaker's win at the World Series as being the thing that really kicks off online poker. So, you know, between 2001 and 2004, it was kind of, first of all, it was kind of a Wild West. I mean, anything sort of went, but they were just really trying to build games and get critical mass and not spend, you know, through blow through too much money because they didn't really have an awful lot of investment. And it turns out that we know now, sort of in hindsight, that cheating started at the site internally as early as 2003. And so when I say cheating started, the crime in question here is that guys that developed and guys that operated and guys that ran an online poker site throughout the entirety of the poker boom, the online poker boom, turned out that they wrote a tool that is pretty widely acknowledged as not being necessary for an online poker site to have. They wrote this tool, they put it in play, and for a period of 5, 6, 7 years, essentially looted their own customers by playing in games with the ability to see everybody's cards. And essentially, if you could see everybody's cards in a poker game, you can be pretty much unbeatable. And they were, and they took a lot of money doing it.
Okay, so that was their crime. Now, eventually, how was it detected, and how did it all explode and stuff?
Yeah, and actually, it's kind of funny because, and I'm glad you sort of brought it in the way you did, because I think to a lot of people, the crime isn't even really all that interesting. You know, it's like, oh, some old school hustlers hustled some other gamblers, and, you know, it just kind of sort of, it's not even, I mean, it's not even really all that sexy of a crime, except for the fact that there was a lot of money and, you know, obviously the fact that they didn't really need to do it in the end. But in the end, the interesting thing for me, at least, and I hope for the viewer of the film, is that it came together, first of all, in a legally gray sort of area. You know, you couldn't really go to the police and say, help, we've been robbed. You know, it's kind of like the thing of, you know, if you're dealing cocaine, I guess you can't really go to the police when somebody steals it from you. And even though it wasn't quite that legally black and white, it had gotten more and more so, because remember in late 2006, the Congress passed something called the UIGEA, which essentially restricted money flows to offshore gambling sites. And so what happens is, with nowhere really to turn and a general suspicion that something's going on because another site, the related site, had actually been caught out with some really ridiculous cheating, players started sort of banding together and swapping hand histories, swapping data, swapping anecdotes, just essentially what I call crowdsourcing a criminal investigation. They essentially came together and did things that in some ways are contrary to poker players. I mean, the great leap of faith for a bunch of poker players to get together and say, look, we need to pool our hand histories. Hand histories are essentially records of all of their gameplay. Because essentially, the minute you show somebody your hand histories, you talk about a tell. That's a real tell. I mean, you're essentially giving your opponent, or who are your opponents in normal day-to-day play, you're giving them a roadmap to how you play the game by sharing hand histories. So really fascinating that these players were able to come together. Even so, they didn't get off to a very good start, because the poker community in general has had a long-standing willingness to support the rooms with something sort of, I mean, it seems natural, but the mantra was the rooms have way too much to lose to ever allow cheating. Hence, there is no cheating. Hence, anybody that raises the question that there is cheating is a crackpot. And that was the environment that they sort of raised this notion. But slowly, the evidence began to mount. People began to dump in a little additional data points and so forth. And pretty soon, the crime began to sort of get outlined in diagram and come into fruition.
Now, I don't think this was in your film, and maybe I remembered this incorrectly, but I thought there was an incident. One of the things that your film brings out very well is that once the talk of this started, Ultimate Bet was very bad about trying to show they were innocent. So when they were asking for hand histories, Ultimate Bet wasn't giving it to them. They weren't giving them the data. But I thought that there was some incident where somebody asked for data and Ultimate Bet inadvertently sent them all the data. And suddenly they had a mountain of data to use that was actually a mistake on Ultimate Bet's part. Am I remembering that wrong?
It's something like that. I'll try and cover it in a way that we don't spend too much time on it, because in a lot of ways it is an ancillary part of the case. It's somewhat important to the case, and specifically to your point, it's important to the case. What happened was when the UIGA passed in 2006, the companies had to find some alternative to the way they were currently configured, because the owners and founders knew that they were going to be under more legal scrutiny, and Ultimate Bet at that point had run a sort of a shell game with a public, in starting a public company, kind of a classic pump and dump scheme where they had set up their company to go public by building a company in Canada. The company went public at a certain valuation, then dropped, you know, quite radically after it went public, and then UIGA passed and they had to take the company private again. When they did that, they partnered up with a sister company that they'd had some connections with in the past, although not real tight, called Absolute Poker. And Absolute Poker was just a site maybe about 40% the size of Ultimate Bet, run by some Montana college guys and you know, just your average online poker site. They were, you know, doing decently well. And what happened was in 2007, for some reason, one of the founders at Absolute Poker actually began to cheat his customers on his site. The two sites were merged, but they weren't merged together from a player pool standpoint. In other words, if you played on Absolute Poker in 2007, you were still playing on Absolute Poker, and same thing goes for Ultimate Bet. And so what happened was when players sort of caught that guy out really quickly, because he was making stupid calls, he was deriding players at the final table, he was just doing everything possible to get caught, essentially. And even then, he wasn't going to get caught, but what happened was the player who was most victimized by the play requested some data from the site and he received a spreadsheet which included far more information than he would normally have gotten. And there's been some speculation that was not really, you know, the old Freud thing, there are no accidents. But it's hard to really say. That the employee that sent it out was a junior level employee. I think he got terminated. So in any case, what happened was that Absolute Poker thing happened. And then they immediately said, no, it didn't happen. You guys are crazy. You're nuts. We deny it all. You know, blah, blah, blah. But it was pretty easy to really call them out on it. They got caught out pretty quickly. They finally admitted it. They paid back some money. They actually paid back with interest because, you know, they recognized this could be the nuclear button for our site. But it's kind of interesting because the minute that all happened, the people at Ultimate Bet knew they were screwed. They knew the minute the Absolute Poker thing took off, the investigation took off, that their cheating would ultimately come to light and that their cheating would ultimately dwarf what was going on at Absolute Poker, because it had been going on for years. And so ultimately what happens is the absolute poker sort of precis allows the ultimate bet sleuths on the 2+2 poker forum to get a little bit more credibility. Indeed, their way of getting data was actually significantly different than getting that spreadsheet from Absolute Poker. They had to actually go out on the open market and buy data, and that's what they did. They went out to a data mining service, a company that actually would sit there and harvest hand histories from poker games and then sell them to other players who wanted to use them for educational purposes, learn how their opponents played, et cetera, et cetera. And they went out and they spent about $5,000, you know, just on a wild-ass guess just to see if they could nail down whether there was really cheating going on at Ultimate Bet. And that data was essentially the critical linchpin to getting taken seriously and discovering that this Neo character was going crazy on the site.
Okay, so good. So that's the general history of what happened. Now let's talk about some of the stuff on the actual film called Ultimate Beat. Now, the two biggest poker player names who were sponsored by Ultimate Bet were Phil Hellmuth and Annie Duke. Both players ran for cover when the scandal broke. Although both players have significant face times in the documentary, the film doesn't leave us with a lot of clarity as to how much, if at all, these two were complicit in the wrongdoing. Now, you've studied this immensely. Do you have any strong feelings one way or the other as about the guilt of either or both of these players?
Well, I think you can come to a pretty good conclusion with both of them, and then I think ultimately the real grayness or the real area that needs to be sort of answered by each individual is what sort of punishment or what sort of what has to come from this on their part. I think we can clearly say that there isn't evidence out there that either of them were involved in day-to-day widespread cheating. It doesn't exist. Now, part of this case is that the data lived up on a sovereign tribal Aboriginal reserve in Canada that was not subjected to law enforcement, actually had a standoff with weapons against the Canadian government at one point in the past couple of decades. So getting to the data was never going to be something that was going to be easy. And then the second thing is, the guys up in Oregon who developed the site and who were, their best friends and made all their money off this stuff, certainly had a cause to be in there, if not messing with the data, at least making sure that the full data didn't come to light. So when the data did come to light, it pretty much nailed one guy, and any evidence of anybody else cheating was not there. Now, we don't know what that means. We don't know if that means that there wasn't, widespread cheating from other people. We can make a guess. We can make educational guesses based on, some of the anecdotal stuff that happened. But I still come back to the thing where I don't think there was widespread cheating by either of those two names, simply because in Phil's case, you really want some plausible deniability with a celebrity, who really had developed a brand recognition over the years and had become a household name in the poker circles. In the case of Ms. Duke, I think probably it just was a situation where she moved up there to help the site in a lot of ways, but you could sort of tell that even though she was working in management, she never really made it into that inner circle with the top three managers up there. And so it just doesn't seem sort of likely that those people, were ending up using the tool. Now, we can make a strong case, though, that pretty much all of their income that they earned from the site in both player sponsorship money and in investment money, and in the way the investment money was sort of ginned up and used in repaying players, and of course, like we say, the actual IPO was a bit of a pump and a dump, there's pretty much no place where money was earned that these people ended up getting as these player sponsors from this site that you can't trace some pretty direct lines back to this cheating thing. So a lot of people will then turn around and say, well, you can't blame Tiger Woods if Nike has a scandal. And I agree with that. I do agree with that, except I think you have to come back to that and say, unless Tiger actually founded the site, right? If Tiger founded Nike, if Tiger had the original Nike idea and drummed up all the investment, then I think that's a little different story, right? I think that's a little different case. And at the same time, if Tiger is being paid in stock options, right, if he's getting a big ownership piece of the site for continuing to work there, then that's another place where, yeah, maybe he does have some culpability and responsibility. And I think that's the case with Phil. And it's definitely the case with Annie to some degree as well. We have good ideas of how much they were paid as celebrity reps on the site, and we also have at least anecdotal ideas of how much their ownership is.
Well, the other big question is, when did they know about the cheating? Like, in the case of Full Tilt, it seems like the owners knew they had a major problem and sort of stuck their head in the sand and wanted to pretend that it wasn't there. So I'm wondering if that was going on with Annie and Phil, where they found out that the cheating was going on but didn't want to, you know, didn't want to deal with the fallout, or do we have any way of knowing, like, whether they knew about the cheating?
I mean, you'd probably have to put somebody on a couch and psychoanalyze them to get them to really own up to the real answer to that question. The one thing that our film explores a little bit is that Phil was kind of like, Let's say Phil was kind of like the Charlie Sheen character in Platoon, you know, with a couple of, guys, father figures in Greg Pearson and Russ Hamilton, you know, as the Behringer and Willem Dafoe characters in Platoon. You know, you had this techie guy up in Oregon, Greg Pearson, who Phil became very good friends with, and really, in a lot of ways, Phil owes pretty much all of his wealth at this point now, and he seems to be a fairly wealthy man. So he pretty much owes all of that to Greg. He's been Greg's great friend all throughout the years, and of course he's been Russ's friend for 30 years or 25 years. So it's pretty sociopathic to say that your best friends would hang you out there and do this behind your back and wreck your site and be working it from inside and doing all of this, and you wouldn't have any inkling at all that it was going on. That is the story he's selling. I mean, that is exactly what he's saying. But, I mean, you might be able to sail that by with me, at least, and say that Russ has that level of sociopathy in him, but I don't know. I mean, I don't get there. I don't really get there. I think they did know. I think they probably didn't know the extent, right? I think they might have known that there was some sort of funny business going on, but it's that kind of thing is, don't ask because you don't want to know.
Now, your film made it pretty clear that basically Phil refuses to talk about the whole thing, right? I mean, but I didn't understand what Annie's position is. So has she ever sort of talked about her, you know, her version of reality?
Yeah, I will go back one quick thing on Phil that's actually a funny data point, because I wish we kind of could have got this video, but it sort of disappeared into the ether and we've never been able to track it down again. He got ambushed once on a red carpet at Caesars, speaking of Caesars, and he was standing there with his father, and the camera guys asked him right out a question, or the interviewer asked him right out a question about the guilt of people at Ultimate Bet. This was like late 2009, so it was after the report came out, you know, giving them guilt or pinning guilt on them. And the first words out of his mouth were kind of a mealy mouth. Well, I think people are innocent until proven guilty. And it's just almost priceless to hear it, because the KGC, the Gaming Commission, who is somewhat conflicted in this case, even they had come to the point of pronouncing guilt. You know, nothing came of it, obviously. But and so for him to say that, that really was his only interview. Now, Ms. Duke is a different story, because we saw her transaction logs at Ultimate Bet. This is another interesting part of the story, is that insiders who were not white knights, they were not whistleblowers, decided to leak documents, leak information, leak materials to the public for some reason. People have speculated on why, but ultimately some information came out. And one of those was a transaction log showing Ms. Duke's account on Ultimate Bet, and she actually got paid in her account. And we actually saw Phil Hellmuth's account, and he didn't get paid in his account. I think that's kind of important, actually. But with Ms. Duke, we actually could see how much she made, and we could see that she actually got paid for public relations. And she spent the better part of 2008 running around selling a whole raft of lies about the site, saying things like every dime had been paid back, saying that, you know, people on Wall Street have no recourse and lose all their money when scammers take their money. And at least in this case, the site stepped forward and did the honorable thing. And I mean, it was enough. I mean, it makes your hair hurt. It's so hard, I mean, to listen to. And so that was kind of the thing with her. And now, ever since then, she's just kind of shut up. Last time I tried to contact her, a Burstyn Marsteller rep got a hold of me and essentially told me I could take a hike.
All right, so we're next going to get into the Ultimate Blackjack Tour, which is also part of this whole thing. But we have about 8-10 minutes in your segment. So if our listeners want to view this film, let's make sure they know how to do this, when it's available, how much it costs, and that kind of thing. So how does somebody get to see it? Is this going to be in the local theaters?
You know, it's probably not going to see a theatrical release. We may do some festivals, and if that happens and we get a distribution deal at some point down the road, maybe it happens. I don't think it'll ever happen. It's really a kind of a thing. I built this project for the poker world. I built it for the poker community because I wanted this story told. It needs to be told, and people need to know this. A lot of these people want to come back into the gaming world. They want to get regulated again. They're trying right now. So the story needed to be told. It's online right now at Vimeo On Demand. And so you can go to the Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O website, and just type in Ultimate Beat, all one word, and that will bring you up to our On Demand page. You can rent the project for 24 hours for $2.99, and you can actually purchase the project in a DRM-free, which means that you can move it around on computers, copy it over, do whatever you want to do with it, for $5.99. I am working on a sort of semi-significant revision that I expect to have done in the next couple of days. But if you purchase it and download it now and watch the current version of it, you will get access to the new version as soon as it's available. And if you want to keep both versions, you can have both.
Very good. That's a very modest price for seeing this. What was the Ultimate Blackjack Tour?
So what happened along the way was we sort of surmised that they used this cheating thing to make a lot of expense payments as the site was growing up without having to go out and generate new investment, dilutive investment that they would have to give away ownership of their site. So the leak stuff tells us that Hamilton was paying out payer payments for, you know, pro rep payments. He was paying out all kinds of expenses related to host services on the site. And when that was all done, it was done sort of in aid of generating as big an IPO as they possibly could get. That happened, and when that was accomplished, you know, that core set of founders cashed out. They made a lot of money. You know, I think Russ probably made somewhere from $8 to $10 million. Greg Pearson, Phil, all those guys made a lot of money. And there was sort of a consensus internally that at that point the cheating would stop. And the problem with that is that, you know, Russ Hamilton He's a hustler. He goes way back. That's what he does. He's done it all his life, and he's probably going to be doing it for all of his life. And he didn't want to stop. And they, for some reason, did not take measures to stop it, right? They didn't disable the software. They didn't turn it off, right? They're software developers. It would have been fairly easy for them to turn off. So I don't really know the motivations why, but they didn't. Russ came up with an idea in 2005, which was kind of interesting in that Lyle Berman had a lot of success partnering with a guy named Steve Lipscomb to start the World Poker Tour, where they started televising poker with this whole card cam tables and getting these tournaments in casinos and then, you know, having online sites run feeder tournaments. And it generated a lot of business for the online sites. It generated a lot of interest in poker, and it really kind of kicked it off. Well, Russ saw the same thing for blackjack, and he convinced everybody in the company that it was a good idea, and they all bought into it. And so in 2005, they started developing this idea. Russ came up with an idea for something called Elimination Blackjack, which allows you to have these tournaments that are a little more exciting because they force the action, a little more television-friendly. They got some Hollywood people behind it. They essentially went out and built a television show similar to the World Poker Tour, and they lined up a bunch of live blackjack tournaments in casinos, places like Verona, St. Kitts, Aruba, of course, and some of the other places. And they really had the idea going in 2006. It was the first season was in the can and being aired on a big network, CBS, versus I guess it was a Travel Channel for the World Poker Tour. So they, you know, they felt pretty cocky and pretty good.
They were incredibly cocky. They paid cash to do the shows. They didn't get them financed by the network. Basically, they paid for the shows and paid for the airtime.
Well, so, the cheated players.
Yeah,
they
sunk an awful lot of money into those shows.
Yes, yes. And it's actually kind of interesting because, you know, they used a lot of cheated money to get those shows done. And in fact, the guy, the showrunner, the Hollywood Los Angeles producer who actually built the shows, what they did was they just created an account on Ultimate Bet. They cheated it up for about $1 million. And then just handed him the keys, and that was payment on his contract for making the show, right? So I mean, the fingerprints were all over the place on building this show. Now, Blackjack was big at Ultimate Bet. By the time 2007 rolled around, you know, Blackjack was responsible for about a quarter of their revenues. So they all really firmly believed that Blackjack was going to be a big deal. Of course, the U.S. government had different ideas, and when it all came down to being a question of would blackjack risk our poker venture, then blackjack would all ultimately get axed. But in this case, what happened was developing this Ultimate Blackjack Tour was huge motivation to keep the cheating scam going. And by 2007, the cheating was as wild as it ever was. I mean, it was taking, you know, several hundred thousand dollars per month out of the games.
Yeah, I played in a number of those Ultimate Blackjack Tour events. I was invited to come play. I never played on any of the televised, any of the final tables. But I remember it was either Aruba or St. Kitts, was in October when the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act got passed. And I remember everybody, you know, because it happened late at night. And I just remember the news like flashing through the rooms. And I mean, it was like, you know, it was like somebody had died.
It was a nuclear bomb. And yeah, it was definitely a bomb. And one of the things that happened immediately that really affected Ultimate Bet maybe even more than Poker Stars or Full Tilt was that NetTeller got shut down. And NetTeller was the company that they relied on maybe more than any of the other sites for their financial processing. And so when that happened to them, they were kind of squeezed, and they got put into a real difficult situation of finding alternative processors. And, of course, that led to that whole thing with the processors – the processing really was what doomed the sites in the end and you know, caused them to start doing all the goofiness where the DOJ stepped in and shut them down.
Scott Bell, thank you very much.
Sure.
We've been talking to Scott about his new documentary, Ultimate Beat. You can get a copy at Vimeo.com, V-I-M-E-O. We actually had quite a few more questions for you. If you can stick around for while we do 10 minutes of business, we would love to throw some more stuff your way.
I have as long as you guys have.
Wow, that's good. All right. Let's talk about our sponsors. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. Double Point Day in November will be Thanksgiving. Midnight to midnight, no limits. The free video poker class this coming week is NSU Deuces Wild. NSU stands for Not So Ugly. It's a particular pay schedule that returns 99.73% when played well. And it's the best available Deuces Wild variation if you play for more than quarters. For most of my playing career, Deuces Wild has been the one game that I personally find the most fun. The class begins Tuesday noon in the showroom. It's free, and everyone at least 21 years of age is welcome. At the Palms, beginning 8 p.m. every Saturday night, you earn tickets for promotions for the next Friday and Saturday. The details are every Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock, 10 winners are called. They each receive $500 and a drawing entry. That entry is to the Saturday night drawing, where one of the 20 winners for that week walks away with $20,000. This means one person will end up with $20,500, and the rest end up with only $500. PEW, Play, Earn, and Win. Gifts for the first part of November include a Kindle Paperwhite, which is a small Kindle, a pseudo-down comforter, and bed sheets. As always, you keep your points. Unredeemed points earned Monday may be spent Wednesday or Friday. Unredeemed points earned Wednesday may be spent on Friday. Tuesdays and Thursdays, you earn free play. This means essentially double points 2 days a week. At videopoker.com, the monthly contest ending today is 100 Play Video Poker with Super Times Pay. It's a fun Halloween version of the game. They call it Spooky Times Pay. The best game to play during that contest is Joker Wild. It's the Atlantic City five-of-a-kind version of Joker Wild. Beginning tomorrow, November 1st, the free daily contest will be 100 Play Draw Poker. On Saturday, they'll have Quick Quads, and on Sunday, the contest will be Wheel Poker. Site's a good place to practice a large variety of games for free. VideoPoker.com is giving away a free month's gold membership to everyone who attends one or more of my video poker classes at the South Point. The gold membership allows you to avoid the pop-up commercials on the site and gives you correction on many games, such as Quick Quads, where you can't get correction anywhere else. On most games, if you have the gold membership, you can change pay schedules and still get the correction on the new pay schedules. All right, next week, our guest is going to be a video poker writer and player with a pseudonym of Royal Cat. I've been friendly with Royal Cat for 15 years and look forward to hearing some of his stories. I'm probably familiar with most of his stories in the 90s, but in 2001, I got booted from the Embryo Mirage properties. And so a lot of Royal Cat stories will be after that, and I'm actually looking forward to hearing them too. In 2 weeks, our guest will be former co-host Michael Shackelford, who runs the Wizard of Odds website. And Michael will be talking about professional football parlay cards. Okay, Scott, we have about 4 minutes left. In addition to Helmuth and Duke, there are pictures of more than 100 different people in the film, some of whom possibly had nothing at all to do with Ultimate Bet. Just being in the film, though, creates a certain amount of suspicion simply by guilt by association, I guess you could say. These people might have a legitimate gripe against being included in a film where they think they had nothing to do with this. What would you say to someone who had no dealings whatsoever with Ultimate Bet and yet their picture was in your film?
Well, one of the things to understand is that I was a very careful and meticulous journalist in building this investigation. I talked to an awful lot of people from the bottom all the way up to the top of the site. We received data internally from the site from multiple different sources. And we've put about 3 years of effort into this investigation. Nobody is in the film on a whim. There's nobody who shows up with a picture only who has nothing to do with it. There are some certain cases, and I think that one that will be a good one to sort of end on is that in this revision I'm doing, one of the things that happened was World Series champion Tom McAvoy is referenced for having been brought in to do a bit of an investigation, and our original cut left it a little gray, a little unknown what was going on there because Tom wouldn't talk to us. Since the film, Tom has talked to us, and he's cleared up his role a little bit. And so I've gone ahead and I've made a little bit of a revision that will be a little more exculpatory about his position. But if somebody's in there without really any cause, they're typically not painted in any kind of a negative sort of way. If somebody was a great friend of Russ Hamilton all the way back to 1983, I mean, you kind of got to own it that the guy was your friend, and that's the bottom line to that.
Well, can I give you an example, if we have time? There's a shot of a guy named Joe Payne where he is talking about basically that his father's side of the family was connected to the mob. Now, was Joe Payne connected to the cheating in any way?
Well, as the film talks, there was definitely a link out there that where Joe had a site that had the Neo reference in it, that the minute that got found out, it got deleted. And Joe worked in those offices where a lot of the cheating was going on. And the name of the Neo account got changed to NY Mobster. I mean, look, it's all circumstantial. I can't say it's not. I tried to talk to Joe, but Joe dealt with me like somebody who was guilty of something. He didn't treat me like somebody who he wanted to say, look, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'd like to tell you clearly what happened because I'm an honest man and I've got nothing going on. But, frankly, that's not the way Joe acted. And I've read an awful lot of stuff on the forums that Joe posted over the years about the Ultimate Blackjack Tour. And so I feel like I have a pretty good insight into the man's character. And, you know, he essentially threatened to sue us, so we're waiting for it. And I feel comfortable with his role in the film, and I feel comfortable with how we left it with him. And I'm going to tell you straight out, my own opinion is that Joe knew everything that was going on.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a pretty clear answer to your question.
Yeah.
We have about 30 seconds to go. Scott, is there anything we haven't mentioned yet that you think people should know about all this?
I just think that thing about, you know, the people coming back into the gaming world is really the big thing. Actually, what I'll do, since I've already said that, I'll just touch on one of your sponsors, actually, because I really think this was so cool. We had a hard time pulling investment in to make this happen, and it was a shoestring budget, and we pulled it off with really almost no dollars at all. And the deal is that one of the last guys that really pitched in and helped us big was Michael Gaughan over at South Point through the guy who's developing their online gaming site, Lawrence.
All right. Thank you, Lawrence. Scott. We're unfortunately out of time. Thank you very much for being here, Scott Bell. Richard, thank you. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes. Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.